Tuesday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball podcast. Got to hit some news real quick. Some interesting stuff. Executive hirings again in Orlando. Some news on Chris Bosh. Opt-ins, opts-outs. Then that Boston-Cleveland game four. Kyrie Irving, unbelievable game. Playoff career high, 42 points. LeBron James with a bounce back as well as expected. And then the big one, Markel Fultz. Projected number one overall pick. We're going to get into a scouting report on him. Danny and I watched a ton of film on him over the last couple of days. We're sponsored today by our friends at Blinkist. Over 2,000 of the best-selling nonfiction books transformed into powerful packs you can read or listen to in just 15 minutes. Blinkist.com/scoutstories. B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. That's how you get started with them. And Harry's Shave. Harry's.com/scoutstories right now will deliver a special offer for fans of this show. $5 off one of their shave sets at Harry's.com/capspace. So let's start with some news here, Danny. What we got?
I think the place to start is with something you and I have followed for a long time, which, and has got some news, which is from Ira Winderman about Miami and Chris Bosh, that it sounds like, and this is something Albert Nahmad has done a great job on over the past few months, that the two sides are coming to an agreement which is kind of going to exist parallel to, but sort of outside the CBA in order to resolve the situation before the new CBA kicks in.
Yeah, under the old CBA, the issue was that if Bosh were removed from the Heat salary cap via a long-term injury exclusion, which a neutral doctor basically said that he couldn't play anymore. But if he played 25 games for another team, then his money would come right back onto the Heat's books, and he still has 2 years left on that five-year max deal that he signed in the summer of 2014. That's unlikely that he would play that for another team, but also, and it wouldn't happen, of course, until after they use their cap space this summer, but it still could really mess up the Heat's books in the future. And so the new CBA, based on the fact that Bosh had this issue with the Heat, deals with things in a different way that, again, we don't need to get into too much of the detail there because it'll take half the show. But essentially now, in what is going to be apparently a hybrid solution between the new CBA process and the old CBA process, they are going to come to an agreement by which if Bosh does play for another team, his salary will not return to the Heat's book. So the Heat, of course, did not waive him prior to March 1st, because then he could have gone on to play for another team. And if he had, he played 25 games for them, then he could have come back on their books as soon as this summer. So now, though, Bosh will have his freedom if, in fact, he can find a team that wants to sign him, and if, in fact, he can manage this condition that, you know, obviously has been very disappointing for him and very difficult to deal with, but also life-threatening.
Yeah, you don't want to lose sight of the bigger parts of this. I mean, this is an issue that is very serious, but he has 2 years, $52 million about left on his contract, and Miami was in a tough place if they hadn't gotten this money cleared, because their team is going to get even more expensive after this summer, because next year Tyler Johnson goes from being a relatively low $6 million, about 5.9, to $19 million, because under the old CBA, if you retained a player who had an offer sheet using the arenas provision, you had to pay him on that payment structure. So they don't have as much space in 2018 as they do in 17, and they only have that space in 17 if they clear Chris Bosh.
And by the way, what a remarkable performance by the Heat over the last 3 years, considering that their highest paid player didn't play for basically two full seasons out of three and didn't finish any of those seasons. I mean, pretty impressive that they were able to be as competitive as they were considering that. More news, Mark Spears at ESPN. I mean, we'd seen a lot of signals on this, such as KD already being announced as doing a Warriors camp in September, but Mark Spears directly asked him if he'd be playing for the Warriors next season, and he said, quote, "Yeah, I love it here. I love my teammates." And, you know, probably wouldn't want to leave either if I'd just been on a team that had the greatest run to the NBA finals ever. You know, maybe things could totally melt down somehow in the finals and everyone hates each other, but it seems pretty darn unlikely.
And while while we'll talk about this more at a later date, the big question is, will he take less money for the coming season in order to facilitate bringing other players back? We don't need to go into it too much, but that is kind of the big question with it. And I guess that's a different question than some people thought we would be discussing going into July 1st.
In pretty obvious opt-ins and opt-outs, Paul Millsap savvily signed a 2+1. He is opted out or will be with the Hawks. And then Mo Spates had signed a 2-year deal at the minimum. with a second year player option, he will be opting out as well. See if he can improve on that or at least get a slight raise from the Clippers as well. And then Josh McRoberts, who signed a star-crossed deal for 4 years with the full mid-level exception, a 3+1, which he was coming off a year as a very solid starter in Charlotte, thought that he would be able to give the Heat something over these last 3 years, just has not been able to stay remotely healthy. All sorts of foot and knee problems, surgeries of various types, really has been, although he gamely played on a broken foot last year in the playoffs, just has not been able to be effective and would not make the $6 million that he is scheduled to make next season if he were on the open market. So a smart move by him to opt in, and we could see the Heat try to move him or potentially stretch him as well, depending on how well they do at getting into the free agent market this season.
Yeah, and they could all, they don't really have a ton of future assets to really dump his contract unless they had a really good reason. In that case, they could certainly make something happen. But then the other interesting big piece of news is on the front office side, and that is John Hammond, who until today was the general manager of the Milwaukee Bucks, is leaving the Bucks to take the same role with the Orlando Magic. He's going to be working with Jeff Weltman, who was just hired to be their president of basketball operations.
And this concludes a very interesting saga in Milwaukee. Hammond was under fire, had been around for a while. I think he is the one who did that JJ Redick trade for Tobias Harris that was kind of a disaster. But he's had some really nice moves as well, getting Chris Middleton and Brandon Knight for Brandon Jennings. That was pretty awesome of a trade, drafting Giannis Antetokounmpo, Thon Maker, although Justin Zanuck was there by the time that they drafted him. It was pretty good. Malcolm Brogdon, I mean, he's had a pretty darn good record, actually. Some kind of ugly free agent signings as well. They've had some misses. The trade of Knight for Michael Carter Williams is certainly a miss as well. But you'll remember, of course, that during that time, it seemed like Jason Kidd was actually wielding more personnel power. And then that now has been removed after the failure of the Carter Williams move. And then they brought in Justin Zanuck from the Jazz. Zanuck, a former agent with Andy Miller at ASM Sports, then joined the Jazz. And he came over to Milwaukee. He actually had a contract that basically said he would start being paid like a top decision maker within a couple of years. I think they were just going to kind of, the plan was to sunset John Hammond. So Hammond technically was still had the final say on basketball decisions, but it was an odd situation with Zanuck in waiting, much the way Bob Myers was brought into Golden State and was not actually made the official decision maker right away when he came in. But it seemed like Hammond was going to either be shunted into a role where he wasn't the primary decision maker or would leave the organization. And now getting the chance to get a 5-year deal in Orlando as general manager below Jeff Weltman, who is coming over from the Toronto Raptors, that seems like a pretty darn good deal for him, and to get some more security when it seemed like, you know, he wasn't going to be the guy going forward in Milwaukee, especially because he actually predated as GM the Lazary and Edens ownership.
Something else that I think is an interesting part of Hammond's time in Milwaukee is that he's done a very good job, not uniformly, but nobody ever does, with second round picks. Early on in his tenure, his first draft, they got Luke Richard and Bob Mute. Later on, Jody Meeks, John Lure, those guys are all still in the NBA. And Orlando, you know, they have some high-end picks of their own, but they also have these two second-round picks from the Lakers beyond their own. And if they can hit on one or maybe even two of those, then that can help build some of the foundation that Orlando needs in terms of cost control and quality for their next good team, whenever the heck that happens.
Yeah, and clearly both Weltman, Toronto's had some success with some hits late in the draft. Hammond hit some of the hits that he's had late in the draft. That seems to be the appeal to Orlando and CEO Alex Martins and the DeVos family, that they need guys who can succeed in the draft, because, you know, I wouldn't say that Rob Hennigan's record was terrible. You know, other than Hezonja, he hasn't had any total misses. You know, Oladipo turned out to be okay and was better than the guys drafted below him, probably. And Elfrid Payton, you know, he's been looking like a borderline starter. Maybe he'll get there, maybe he won't with the number 10 pick, although it was a bad deal to trade Philly's 2017 pick back to them. That would have been a pretty nice pick, as it turned out, and in that deal. And Aaron Gordon, you know, again, probably looking like a better draft pick than like Dante Exum or Marcus Smart or Julius Randle below him. So that's not a bad pick either, but they still didn't come anywhere close to getting a superstar. And then obviously the profligate spending and free agency and the Serge Ibaka trade ended up being the death knell for Hennigan. Anything else, or can we move on to Boston and Cleveland?
I'm still a little bit sad that you unprompted brought up Hezonja, but other than that, we can move on.
Yeah, and let's move on, in fact, to Blinkist. Blinkist is a really cool idea. In fact, I'm not going to say that they stole my idea because I never did anything to actually put this into action, but I used to read a fair amount of nonfiction books or listen to nonfiction books, and I felt like they were too inefficient, basically. That if you're reading nonfiction, you're not going to, you can't take away an entire 200 pages worth of information or 500 pages worth of information that you just are going to have at your beck and call. That's just not realistic. And nonfiction, a lot of it is not particularly entertaining. You're reading it for the key insights that you can take away to improve your life, to gain more knowledge. So what Blinkist does is they take over 2,000 of the best-selling nonfiction books and they transform them into powerful packs you can read or listen to, which I like the best, in just 15 minutes. I've actually even told a bunch of my friends who love reading nonfiction and are always trying to improve their lives about this, even outside of this podcast. And I think it's great for them. I think it would be great for anyone, really, who loves to learn more. I mean, think of if you have a 45-minute commute, you get through three books. That would be amazing. You just focus on these key ideas. They have books like How Champions Think or Shoe Dog, Mindful Athlete, How to Win at the Sport of Business. Blinkist gives you more knowledge in less time, big ideas in small packages. So right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. If you go to Blinkist.com, Blinkist.com/capspace right now, you can start your free trial or you can get 3 months off a yearly plan when you join today. Once again, that's Blinkist.com/capspace. Capspace, easy to remember because we talk about it on the program so often. Once again, Blinkist.com/capspace. That'll get you your free trial or 3 months off a yearly plan when you join today. So when Boston led this 57-47, did you think there was any chance at halftime that they're actually going to pull this off and go back to Boston tied at 2-2?
I certainly thought there was a chance. I didn't think they were necessarily the favorites in it because they had awfully close to a perfect storm in that first half. The most shocking part of that was LeBron James getting not only in foul trouble, but getting in deep foul trouble and sitting out the last 6:45 of the second quarter due to getting his fourth foul on Terry Rozier on a completely legitimate offensive foul.
Yeah, it was. We saw LeBron, I thought, the first 6 minutes or so. He kind of played the way he played it in game three, and then he got much, much more aggressive. But that actually got him a couple of offensive fouls as well, two of which were on Rozier. There was that charge, which I thought was a pretty good charge. And then he also went up for an alley-oop, and Rozier did a nice job switching on him and got pushed in the back. He had another play where he hit Marcus Smart in the face, and then he clearly fouled Jarepko. I mean, all four of the calls were legitimate. But I would have left him out there too if I were Tyronn Lue because LeBron almost never fouls out of games. So I thought it was the right decision to leave him in with three and he got his fourth. But then Kyrie Irving immediately started cooking. Once LeBron got his fourth foul, Kyrie then scored 33 points in the next 19 minutes.
And importantly, considering how part of LeBron's MVP case was the team falling apart without him, in that 6:45 where he had to come out, the lead state ended up the same, but it went back and forth a little bit, and the Cavs scored 117 points per 100 possessions during that time, which is pretty awesome for them without LeBron.
Yeah, and Boston did defend them quite well, but I thought a key was that they just stopped turning the ball over. They had, I think, 8 turnovers in the first quarter, I want to say, or very close there too, and Kyrie started going off, and that was really huge for them. And I thought Boston, both with some ugly turnovers, some missed open threes, really missed a chance to go up into the high, like up by high teens in at halftime, and that might have made it a little bit more difficult to come back. Cleveland probably would have done it anyway, frankly, but it was really some missed opportunities there. They ended up building that 10-point lead at halftime based mostly just on more possessions. They held Cleveland to one offensive rebound, they got on the offensive glass a fair amount, and then they forced those turnovers and didn't turn it over hardly at all themselves. And then in the third quarter, it turned into a disaster despite Kyrie's heroics, which we can talk more about. But in the third quarter, in which Cleveland outscored Boston 40-19, Boston turned it over on 23% of their possessions, including four of their first seven possessions, which really got Cleveland's momentum going there. And Boston just couldn't score. I mean, I thought that was the bigger problem for them with only 23 points on 26 possessions. They had been killing them. And Cleveland made some nice defensive adjustments. They were getting killed on slips of screens, and then they were able to switch a little bit more. They increased the pressure as well on Boston. Boston didn't shoot it as well. They turned it over more. And think they all brought more energy. I thought Kevin Love's defense in this game was actually outstanding.
It was. He led the game with 6 deflections and was just active there, making also not necessarily contesting shots, but just being in the way, which is incredibly important. Also, I believe he set a playoff career high in rebounding with 17, and just a nice game from him top to bottom. And you wouldn't think that a guy getting a 17-17-5 would be, his box score would be underrating his performance, but I would say that it did for Love in this game.
Yeah, and he's always actually been a guy who graded out really well by some of the plus minus metrics. And I mean, he also had some dominating offensive rebounds late. Like, he had one where he stared down Jay Crowder afterwards, where Crowder had him boxed out and Love with one hand held him off and then like turned his right hand inside out and reached over Crowder and grabbed the rebound and got a foul late to kind of put the game away. And I think he still, despite the fact that he's lost a bunch of weight and plays out in the perimeter much more, I think he still loves getting down there on the offensive glass. And that's something that might be crucial in the next series for Love. Let's get to Kyrie Irving though. And when he really got going in this second quarter, or I'm sorry, in the first and the second quarter, and then in the third, I mean, they had Avery Bradley on him, and Kyrie hit like a big three in his face. That's one thing. Bradley doesn't have a ton of length to get out if he's not right up on the guy. And Kyrie started hitting really difficult shots on him. Then Terry Rozier got absolutely roasted, both before and after Kyrie sprained his ankle, which we thought might be more of a tweak than it was. It'd be interesting to see whether that swells up on him and they consider holding him out of game five now with this dominating lead in the series. But the way he went down, you thought it might be bad, but then after seeing the replay, it didn't look like too bad of a tweak, and he was able to warm it up and keep playing. And also the fact that he can jump off his right foot and still finish with his right hand so easily as well is also huge. So it was, I mean, some of the shots that he made were just completely ridiculous. Like the first one after he sprained the ankle, not the one where he got like off of 2 feet, where he got like that lob pass from LeBron, which was a ridiculous pass. But then when he drove from the right side into the lane, pulled up over the help defense and on his right foot, right hand, leaning back, and one was just like one of those unbelievable shots that really, you know, he's one of the few guys in the league who can make that type of play.
He was incredible. Kyrie, especially in the playoffs, just his ability to create and his ability to make tough shots are both out of this world special. And I want to go through a little bit of his third quarter just because you don't see this very often. So you mentioned that Boston, there was a 40-23 quarter, so Boston had 23 points. Kyrie Irving had 21 points in the third quarter on 10 shots and 10 shooting possessions, because he only had one free throw, which was on an and one. And so you'd say, okay, you know, maybe he made a bunch of threes. Nah, he was 2 of 3 from threes. He just didn't miss from two. He was 7 of 7 on twos and just annihilated what was at points good defense, at points bad defense, but it didn't matter. He was just killing it.
Yeah, and then he did most of his damage in the third quarter, and then LeBron James went to work in the fourth, and, you know, LeBron was criticized. He only took 13 shots in game three. He took 18 shots in the second half alone, making up for, but I think he had taken 9 shots in the first half before he went out as well. So he took a ton of shots, but was efficient, 10 out of 18. Did hit a big three late, although his jumper has not been quite as money as it had been earlier in the playoffs. And Boston's strategy early actually was not guarding him at the three-point line, which actually kind of worked a little bit. But he got it going in the fourth, hit 3 out of 4 from mid-range, including one. That turnaround jumper that he had in the post, late clock on Marcus Smart, where he just basically jumped with his feet facing the baseline, like barely looked at the rim over his right shoulder and made it, like, that was just a completely preposterous shot. There was I think that I'm not really sure what more Boston could have done defensively in a lot of ways. I mean, I think more Marcus Smart on Kyrie would have helped, because I think Smart's length when Kyrie really gets going with the jumper is probably the best way to deal with him in ISO. Because Kyrie was really, a lot of it was just ISO on the right wing. And that's where he put Rozier in particular in the torture chamber. But in some of these shots, there's just nothing you can do about him basically. And Boston doesn't have, although Al Horford is a solid rim protector and solid moving his feet, he had to guard Kevin Love, so that didn't really work very well. Oh, I guess I did think of something Boston could have done differently. Not played Tyler Zeller a single minute, because he was awful once again.
That would have helped. And
even with Amir Johnson out, like Al Horford didn't play that many minutes, right? He was only on like 24 minutes at the end of the third quarter, and they just didn't bring him back fast enough, I thought. He did play 21 minutes in the second half, so it's hard to say that they should have played him more. But I mean, go to Jerebko more. Jerebko only played 9:52. Olynyk only played 8 minutes, and Zeller, you know, ended up playing 212, but he was -5 in that period, and that's part of when they really were getting roasted. I know it's like, you know, 5 points in 2 minutes is not very good, and a lot of that was directly at his expense. Kyrie in the pick and roll just completely broke his ankles on one play.
It might not be possible to do this, but I wish that they could count free throws for the people who were on the floor when the foul occurred, as opposed to the people who were on the floor when the shot occurred, because he was actually -6, but he was off the floor for that last shot, which I believe he committed that foul, or he was involved. I think he blew the play, whether it was his foul or not. Something else that I hadn't noticed during the course of the game is that Jay Crowder was the only Celtic to hit more than one three-pointer. He was 4 of 7. He did a nice job. He hit a couple with some real confidence behind it, but they were just getting some shaky shooting performances. And one of the things we were looking at, I put it second on our bullet points for the Twitter NBA show, was Marcus Smart's shot selection and his success. His selection, as expected, not particularly great, and his success was distinctly awful because he was 1 for 9 and that one make was a banker.
You know, he went 7 for 10 last game. I thought he was going to improve. I thought he was going to go 8 for 10 in this game. No, he did not do that. He did get to the foul line a little bit with some more BS three shot fouls, although he then indirectly caused Jay Crowder to injure what looked like his groin because Smart flopped for a three shot foul, and then Crowder next time down actually slipped on the pool of sweat under Smart, although the arena should be able to clean that up while the ball was down at the other end of the floor, because I think there was a trip back and forth on that.
I can't remember whether there was or there wasn't, but either way, I mean, why do you... I don't know if you caught it, but there was actually a play during the, I think it was the third quarter before that, where a guy fell near Cleveland's bench, and I think it was Richard Jefferson just like threw his towel on the ground and wiped it up before the guys came back. He just did it himself.
So it's now 3-1 Cleveland. LeBron James doesn't suck, as everyone seemed to think that he did after that one bad game that he's had in the playoffs. He had 34, Kyrie had 42, Love had 17, nobody else on the team had more than 7. They did play Kyle Korver quite a bit. Korver actually had an interesting line, +12 in 20 minutes and did not attempt a field goal. But I thought he did well also defensively, and we saw that just Boston still does not really have anyone dynamic. I felt that especially as they started to struggle, a lot of it ended up being Avery Bradley pick and roll, then switching Tristan Thompson onto him, and Avery Bradley has no chance off the dribble against Tristan Thompson, or most guys, but I mean, he's that's not the type of player he is. He comes off of screens, you know, he goes back door. And I felt like they could have gone to Smart more in the post against Irving, especially once he got hobbled. They could have gone to Jaylen Brown more when he was guarded by Korver. I think going to a more Cleveland-like offense to just try and create some shots. I know that's not what Brad Stevens believes in, but when every possession was just devolving into a late clock switch with Avery Bradley trying to go one-on-one, and Bradley struggled to 7 of 19 shooting 1 of 7 on threes, it was just too difficult. And I thought they could have maybe gotten into the post more with Horford. Horford, I thought, 7 of 11. I mean, he had some real tough shots in the post. Also had 7 assists. He had a wonderful game. So I think offensively, they're going to have to come up with something a little bit different. That adjustment of just slipping every screen and getting into the lane, I thought, with their bigs and then setting up corner threes, worked great in the first half. But I think Cleveland was able to finally shut that down with superior talent. LeBron James was more engaged as well. That helped. Love, of course, was excellent. But I mean, how about putting Kevin Love in a pick and roll, you know, instead of Tristan Thompson? I mean, you're playing with two bigs on the floor, have Love's guy come up and set the screen instead. You know, I mean, they had Horford and Olynyk out there, so either of those guys is quite capable of setting the screen, and whoever's guarded by Love should be able to do that.
Another little wrinkle I wanted to mention, just because both of us, but especially you, enjoyed it so much, was a play where Boston essentially pre-shorted their own pick and roll and just got an absolutely beautiful look for Kelly Olynyk out of it.
Yeah, that was nice. Where, and again, shorting, if you don't know what that is, it's basically when they are trapping the pick and roll, you throw it to the wing, and then the wing has the passing angle to get the roll man on the dive, because it's really hard to throw that pass over two guys when you're being trapped. And so they actually did it before the screen even got set. and that worked great. But you know, you can only really get by with stuff like that for so long when you're relying on that. And then if it doesn't work out, you end up in the late clock and you got no one to create a shot. I mean, and that stuff works great because, especially with Golden State, because they got Klay Thompson and Steph Curry out there, and now this year Kevin Durant. So you got to really bite on that. You're freaked out whenever those guys might get open, and that's how all the backdoor stuff opens up. If you don't have dynamic scorers and shooters that the defense is worried about, you can only go so far with that type of deception.
So at this point, it feels like it's more just a matter of when, not if. But that's still, I don't mean that in a way to just denigrate the Celtics. It's just that, especially without Isaiah, they're just not a good enough team.
Yeah, and we saw Cleveland finally solve their defense. And again, I thought their defense was pretty good. They didn't make too many mistakes. And when you've got Smart and Bradley in the backcourt, I mean, that's probably the best defensive backcourt in the league if you're playing those two guys. But it's also probably one of the worst offensive backcourts in the league. And while having great shooting and passing big men like Olynyk and Horford helps some to make the life a lot easier for their limited perimeter players, you know, again, that can only go so far, especially when you have individual defenders like someone like Tristan Thompson as a big defender who can get out on the floor and guard late in the clock.
If only there were a way that they could make their backcourt better offensively.
All right, let's talk about Markelle Fultz. But first, this is from our friends at Harry's Shave. Danny, I know you really love their foaming shave gel.
I do. It's a product that I've been looking for a good shave gel for a long time, and I had no expectations and just kind of, you know, received Harry's and just was going through all of the different materials and just went, wow, this is great. And I've been using it ever since, and I don't think I'm ever going to look back.
Yeah, this is your chance at harrys.com/capspace. That URL can get you $5 off one of their shave sets just in time for Father's Day. They have a limited edition Father's Day set. Comes with a storm gray razor handle, chrome razor stand, foaming shave gel, which Danny so enjoys, 3 replacement blades, and a travel cover, and it's packaged in a sleek, giftable box. I happen to really like their razors. They have great wash through, an industry term. You can shave faster because you put, after you shaved once, and I don't shave that often, if you know, from watching the Tour NBA show. So when I do shave, you know, I've got like a lot of whiskers in there, and on a normal razor, it takes a while to wash it out, but Harry's actually has better wash through. So I can wash it out and get back to shaving and get the process done with faster using their shave gel and their great razors, which are manufactured in Germany. They actually bought a factory in Germany to manufacture their razors. Harry's also has a 100% quality guarantee, so they'll give you a full refund if you are not happy. Once again, the way to get started with them, harrys.com/capspace right now. Harry's will give you $5 off one of their shave sets. This is for a limited time only. So act now! That's harrys.com/capspace for $5 off. And of course, to let them know that you came from us. Well, the first three prospects that we looked at, I like Jonathan Isaac, Jason Tatum. Someone actually sent me a video of Tatum from Drafts Express hitting 18 straight NBA three-pointers, and supposedly he's reworking his shot, and he does shoot a very high percentage from the line too, so I'm not saying he can't improve his NBA three-pointer quite a bit, but you know, we hear that about every single draft prospect, so it's hard to separate the wheat from the chaff there. But Tatum, Josh Jackson, Jonathan Isaac, you know, guys who are being talked about in the top five, I wasn't like so wowed by any of them as a top five prospect. I had seen a little bit of Markelle Fultz, not as much as a lot of people, just saw him really for one day at the Hoop Summit practice and then the game, and you know, seen a little bit of highlights here and there. He's worth it. He's worth the number one pick to me. He was totally impressive offensively, and you know, I was definitely wowed by his skill level, and I think, you know, he's definitely, watching him, you're like, okay, this is what a number one overall pick in the draft is supposed to look like.
He is absolutely tantalizing, because you see these moments with him and they just make you say, oh my god, if he could do this with any frequency, like some of the dribble moves that he got, some of the separation he could generate, you're just sitting there going, oh my god, like this is legitimately special. And some of it was against, you know, the Western Michigans of the world, but some of it was also against the Pac-12 competition they played. And the flashes he shows are at that incredibly bright level. I don't think he's that, not even the like the first tier. The first tier of like number one picks is like the LeBron type, where it's like no chance they miss. I'm not sure he's in that second group, which is more like Karl Anthony Towns, where it's like an exceedingly low chance, but he's still clearly to me worthy of the status that is being the top prospect in this draft or most drafts.
Yeah, and I'm not saying he's better than Lonzo Ball yet. I haven't watched enough of Ball to say. But I mean, just looking at him and being like, okay, like I feel comfortable that this guy is good enough to be a number one overall pick. I definitely felt that. I mean, when you and I watched, we sat down and watched him for about 2 hours today. We just basically watched like all of his possessions during the year, probably got through about two thirds of them. And we probably rewound it like 15 times where like, oh shit, look at that move type of stuff. And he plays with a very unique style. He kind of bounces in and out of his moves and, you know, he's very smooth, but then when he'll kind of get up on his toes as he's moving pretty quickly and then get into a move, whether it's an inside out dribble, whether it's, he does these great live dribble spin moves that are awesome, whether it's a step back, whether it's a crossover, and he's got this big looping crossover that would drive Fred Hoiberg completely crazy. I guess he just hates any dynamic guard out of the University of Washington. But just his moves off the dribble are truly special. His operation in the pick and roll. I mean, that's the biggest thing, is just how many moves he has, how many times he's able to blow by guys, split defenders, just make your jaw drop with some of these moves that he has off the dribble in transition, semi-transition, coming off the pick and roll in an ISO situation. I mean, if you were a running back, you'd talk about how he makes guys miss, you know, and that's what he does. He makes guys miss on the basketball court.
I don't think he's all the way there in terms of maximizing the separation he creates, but think back to D'Angelo Russell, a guy that I liked, and I think I was a little bit too high on compared to where I should have been. Not that he's a bad player, but he's just not where I wanted him to be. And it's that idea of separation. And if you can get that, you can generally make it work. And his passing vision is good. It's not elite, you know, it's not Ricky Rubio, it's nothing like that. But what I love about him is he has the building block that most guys would kill for, and you can figure the rest out.
Yeah, and actually I watched a little bit more tonight also after you went home, and I think in when you're watching full games instead of just his assists, all his passing can actually look better, because he had just these terrible bigs on this team that would just like bobble every pass out of bounds or like get their shot blocked or something. So when you're looking at all of his assists, like sometimes that doesn't show up as well. Had a nice eye for skip passes, and this wasn't a team that had a ton of spacing. They didn't really have anybody else really who could do a ton on this team. They were really bad, especially defensively, which we'll get to. His defense is a problem, but that he's going to really need to put some work in on. But I mean, I think he led the Pac-12 in assists or something like that, maybe that was ball, but he was definitely, you know, 6.5 assists or whatever, really good for a college point guard, especially with his scoring mentality. So I think like he definitely is not selfish, especially early in games. He's probably even guilty of running the offense and letting their other crappy players do too much. And so I think he's going to be definitely a very solid passer, and I wouldn't rule out him becoming like a very good passer at the NBA level, especially when you consider how much he'll be able to attack it in space if you put some shooting around him. I mean, God, with the shooting and the system that Boston has, I mean, he's going to be fantastic. I also really like the way he attacks with a live dribble. I think he's going to be early on in Boston system if they draft him very effective in that way, where he's able to kind of catch it smoothly on the move and make, you know, a really slick move, get right into his move by crossing over. He almost like has started his dribble before he catches the ball. And so it just, he's got so many moves. It's really, really impressive what he's able to do off the dribble at 6'5 with a 6'10 wingspan. What do you think about his shooting?
He's more confident in his jump shot than I am in his jump shot, but it goes in pretty frequently, so I can't knock it too much. I'm a little bit queasy more on his runner floater kind of from 10 feet and in. That makes me uncomfortable. I think he can get better at that. But I mean, it's hard to...
Yeah, he was okay off two. I thought he was good off 2 feet, but his 1 foot runner definitely needs some work.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. And you also worry because he shot 65% from the free throw line, and just like anybody else, he's shooting more free throws than threes. So you think about that a little bit. I think he'll be okay, but those are saying like, oh, he's definitely going to be a knockdown shooter or something like that. I'm not at that point at all yet. But what did you see?
Well, he shot 41% on three-pointers, which is ridiculous. And he's able to rise up over a contest that doesn't really seem to bother him that much. I mean, but his shot is still a little inconsistent. Like, he has this instinctive feel. He has these great moves, but he still has a lot about his game that he's got to tighten up. And whether that's shooting the same shot every single time, that's a big part of it. So, you know, I'm not going to say he's going to be a 40% three-point shooter in the NBA. I mean, he does have the ability to come off of screens and rise up. You know, he may need to I didn't see him pulling up like from NBA range. He's pulling up for the college three and a lot of times contested and shooting over guys, you know, especially if he's going to be guarded by a point guard. You know, he's going to be able to get to his spot and rise up over smaller point guards very easily. But I don't know if he can take that exact same type of shot from NBA three. You know, I think it may take him a couple of years to get comfortable from that range. You know, he's not like Lonzo Ball where he's pulling up like, you know, from NBA range on a regular basis. I also thought actually that his finishing was a little bit disappointing to me. He gets there so easily to the rim, but you know, he's not really going to like dunk on people that often. Every once in a while he'll come in, but he's kind of more like a length dunker. He can explode, but again, a lot of times, like you and I were sitting there watching it and like, you know, it looks like he gets to the rim and he's got like a shot that you would expect him to finish and he just, you know, wouldn't quite make it. So I think as he gets stronger, maybe a little more athletic, gets more used to dealing with quality size at the rim, I think he can get better at that. I'm also a little bit concerned though. My one concern about him offensively is whether he can be efficient. So I don't know for sure if he's going to be, you know, a high 30s three-point shooter. And you know, I think he can punish the defense if they go under and he's open, but and coming off a screen, you know, maybe that's not necessarily going to be his game. And then a lot of the fouls that he got were kind of like BS college fouls, not plays where he's really attacking the big and getting into their body and aggressively drawing contact. And his free throw rate is not that high. It's only like 35%, which is not enormous for a college guard. And he doesn't really have any kind of like bullshit foul drawing capability like we see from NBA guards. But few college guards have that. Most guys it takes them being in the NBA to develop that. But if he's not getting to the foul line a ton and he's not hitting his free throws at a great percentage, I think he'll get better there. You know, I think he'll end up being, you know, a high 70s free throw shooter eventually because he's too good from outside to be that to shoot 65% from the line all the time. You know, I think he'll just tighten up and kind of get better at it. Like, I mean, that's one of the things I would say about him is he just has so much natural talent and there's just like a lot of things that he just needs to tighten up and get more consistent at. But I mean, that natural talent, that ability off the dribble, his ability to rise up from mid-range, the passing ability, which is very solid in pick and roll. I mean, he's an elite pick and roll scorer. It's just not something that you can teach. So he's got the stuff that you can't teach, and I think the stuff that you can teach, he can get a lot better at.
A couple of basics with him, just in case people don't have the visual for Fultz. About 6'4 and about a 6'9 wingspan. There are a couple different measurements for him from 2016 from the Hoop Summit and Team USA that kind of go one direction or the other on that, but I think that's a good calibrator for him. Still 185. I think if he could put on a little bit more weight, it would help, as long as he doesn't lose any of his quickness, because that's part of what makes him special. The other thing I wanted to say in that kind of vein is, I think back to a very different position, but Alex Len, when he played at Maryland, he just had nobody around him.
Don't you dare reference Alex Len and Marco Fultz in the same sentence.
No, there's a reason for it. And it's because I thought that it was hard to evaluate parts of what Len did at Maryland just because his teammates were so bad. And what Marco Fultz has is, in many ways, while players like his potential future teammate Isaiah Thomas have pushed point guard in a little bit of a different direction, in many ways, point guard is still a talent distribution position. And when you were out of the room for a couple minutes, I was watching some De'Aaron Fox highlights, and a lot of his assists were just passing to like a four who could shoot. And I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. Other teams have those guys. That's something that Markel Fultz could really use.
Yeah, he definitely, if you put him in with a big who can pick and pop, for example, I mean, like, that's something we didn't see any of. That, you know, he's going to play with plenty. I mean, he's going to play with Al Horford for sure, and, you know, maybe Kelly Olynyk will still be around as well. Let's get to his defense, though. It sucks. It's really bad. Washington's defense overall was really bad. I mean, I watched two full games of him. I maybe saw him get into a stance and slide his feet once over the course of those entire two games. And other than like every once in a while, he'd go for like a chase down block. That's the only time I ever really thought like, wow, this guy is hustling. Like, he just doesn't really make hustle plays. He was okay on the glass, you know, 13% defensive rebound rate. But a lot of those, you know, you didn't see him just like skying over guys to get defensive rebounds. And he certainly was part of a terrible defensive culture. Their defense was terrible last year. Like, Lorenzo Ramar got fired. I'm not going to comment on whether he should have been or not, but definitely was not exactly teaching great defense these last few years. So, I mean, I think a lot of his coaching, but he's more of a smooth athlete than an unbelievable athlete, and his ability to change speeds and his ability to attack in a straight line and then like subtly change direction or go for a Euro step. That's a different different movement than sliding your feet, getting your butt down, getting those short choppy steps where you really get up on guys. He does have that 6'9", 6'10" wingspan. So I think he can definitely, you know, guard ones or twos. I think he's going to get pretty strong pretty soon. You know, he's got like a nice frame for sure. But just anytime he moved, you know, whether it was a closeout, you know, he would just kind of run at the guy and there's no breaking down into a stance and trying to slide, you know, or even if he's in a zone defense, he's just like running straight. He's not sliding. The rare times he would try to get into a stance, he would not get his butt low enough and would get out of it very quickly. So, you know, he's going to have to learn how to do it, but he does not have any kind of instincts for defense. You know, he gets some steals, he gets some blocks. So, and a lot of that's, but you almost never see him really with any kind of intensity out on the floor. And, you know, I don't want to say that because he's a quieter kid or because he doesn't show a ton of emotion on the floor that like you can't be a good defensive player. Like Tim Duncan is one of the best defensive players of all time and he didn't do any of that, but it does show into the pattern of he's not playing with intensity. And, you know, he's playing 36 minutes a game or whatever and has a 30% usage rate in a college game. So, you know, I'm not going to say that he can't learn that, but I definitely didn't see it at all. I mean, he had some of the worst defense that I've seen from a guard prospect in a long time, at least one with his physical tools.
On defense, he reminds me a little bit of Kyrie in that you see the physical potential for him to be decent, but you don't see it in his play very frequently. And so that can be frustrating. But at the same point, when you are, you know, when you're a 19-year-old kid, I'm not going to write him off in any way, shape, or form doing that. But we still have to see a whole heck of a lot more, not only in terms of awareness, but also just intention and activity. And a benefit of being in an NBA system is that will be, they will do their best, whether they can succeed or not, they will do their best at basically indoctrinating him. And that being on the Celtics will help that even more, just if that's where he ends up going, just because that's the only way he's really going to see the floor that much unless they do something like trade Isaiah. So he can get some of that foundational work. But again, it goes into the idea of natural tools. Like what he can be is pretty incredible. Whether he gets there on the defensive end is unlikely, but possible.
Yeah, the Kyrie analogy is an interesting one, but Kyrie, at least we know he can't get over screens, but if he's like in an ISO, we've seen him actually move his feet and guard a little bit, whereas Fultz, maybe he can do it, but I wouldn't know because I never even saw him attempt to slide with anyone. So I think he maybe did it one time and he didn't look like, you know, that quick. And again, he's a smooth athlete. He takes big steps. He changes direction. It's not those short, choppy, intense steps, you know, waving around, getting your chest into the guy's face, moving with like really quick, small steps. You know, I think it's somewhat similar. I mean, I think he's hopefully won't be on this level, but kind of similar to DeMar DeRozan as well, where DeRozan has that ability to jump at the rim. He's got those Euro steps. Markel is much more dynamic off the dribble, I think, than DeRozan, just in terms of his speed and transition and the moves that he has. Not the finisher at the rim that DeRozan is, and DeRozan is a bigger guy as a peer too, but just in terms of like, he reminded me a lot of DeRozan just from a defensive standpoint. And I'm not saying that he can't get there, but I mean, we've seen zero evidence of that on film other than just the fact that he's a pretty athletic guy on offense and has pretty good wingspan. And every once in a while he'd get up for like a chase down block off of 1 foot.
Anything else you feel like here? I was trying to think of if we could each pick a favorite highlight of the plays that we saw, but I'm not sure I could pick a single one. Actually, I have one in my head. That lefty dribble he had, I can't remember he had kind of a crossover and then went into a lefty dribble and just kind of took off, and I was just like, oh wow, like that, yeah. It was special.
No, I mean, he does interesting stuff that you just don't see. And actually, one of those, this is the one that I think I highlighted on Twitter that Jabari Parker did, which, you know, obviously Jabari's at a larger size, but where he basically like crossed over and then did like a hesitation after the crossover that really just froze the defender. So he's got that. I mean, these live dribble spin moves are just like, you got to see these to believe. I mean, if you haven't watched it yet, the Draft Express video, the extended one that Mike Schmitz did, is good. But like, we saw probably like, you know, another like 10 wow plays in the possessions that we looked at outside of the ones that Schmitz highlighted in the video. yeah, I mean, some of the stuff that he does off the dribble is just completely insane. I think that's all I got, though. Oh, and I guess the other thing I would say, too, is if they want to play him and Isaiah Thomas in the same backcourt, they are never going to stop anybody next year.
Their bigs would get so many fouls.
It's going to be it'll be a complete disaster. Like, and he's pretty young. Like, he doesn't even turn 19, I think, until the end of the month. So he's young for a guy who's in the draft after their freshman year. But it's very difficult for me to imagine that he can get to playing like playoff Boston Celtics level of defense in just 1 year. And I think he could have a season where, you know, he comes in off the bench, he plays backup point guard, he shows all these wow factors. The fans are like, why the hell isn't he playing more? And the answer is because he just, you know, cannot play winning basketball in the defensive end. And so maybe, but it's possible, though, that that'll be good for him, you know, where he is forced to tighten up on that end. And, you know, he'll be forced to, like, much like Jaylen Brown, tighten up his spot up shooting, some of the plays that you need to make winning basketball that he does have to get better at. Maybe he'll be forced to do that early in his career to get on the floor. Whereas, you know, if he goes to the Sacramento Kings or something, which would have been impossible, of course, because as the graphic overlaying Dave Yeager told us at the lottery, they had a 0.0% chance at the number one pick this year. But if he went there, then he's just got the ball in his hands all the time. He's worried about scoring, and, you know, there's no accountability because there's no one behind him, and he's going to play every game regardless of whether he gets better or not. So maybe this will be a better thing long term for his career to go to the Celtics, maybe just in the same way that Jaylen Brown has experienced that. But we'll see. I'd definitely be very fired up as a Celtics fan to watch this guy next year.
He's a special talent, absolutely a special talent. And since it sounds like we're about at the end, I'll plug that my Spurs preview came out on Tuesday, and I don't know for sure, but I'm guessing it's going to be my Pacers one that comes out on Wednesday at SI.
Yeah, my Pacers and Grizzlies previews are the two previews every year that usually get the lowest number of listens. So I kind of take that as a proxy for whoever has the smallest fan base. So look forward to no one reading your piece, I guess.
It's my it's at the Wonderful Sports Illustrated. People will read it. People care about what I write.
No, that's true. And given some of the smaller outlets that you and I have written for, including ones that we named in rather unfortunate fashion at times.
Hey, I love the name of my small outlet. Thank you very much.
Vegan Fish Tacos?
Yeah, there's a story behind it. It's on the About page.
Is that website actually still exists, huh?
Damn straight.
I let the team rebound expire this year. I didn't really have any use for it anymore. All right, we were rambling here. Don't forget about our sponsors today, Blinkist.com/catspace. You can get 3 months off your year-long subscription, or you can get a free trial. And Harry's.com/catspace. You can get $5 off one of their shave sets. We'll be back tomorrow with more awesome NBA content. Till then.